This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. College basketball is a part of North Carolina's lifeblood, and team allegiances are not taken lightly. But the head coach of North Carolina Central University's men's basketball team is deeply respected both by those who wear the Eagles jersey and those who compete against it. Lavelle Moten is head coach of the Eagles. He led the team to their first Mideastern Athletic Conference championship. That was in 2014. And his work has not gone unnoticed. Lavelle has racked up a long list of accolades, including two-time recipient of MEAC Coach of the Year. But well before his success as a coach, Lavelle was a kid growing up in a single-parent home in the projects of Boston and later in a rough neighborhood outside of downtown Raleigh. But his family and community recognized Lavelle's talent and helped him stay on a path to success. And Lavelle Moten joins us now. Coach Moten, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit about growing up. You were in Raleigh for a while, but before mm-hmm. that, you were in Boston, right?
Yeah. The south end of Boston, you know, when people speak about Boston, you hear about the Tea Parties and the Celtics and the Patriots and Foxborough and all of those wonderful things. But the south end of the city is often gets lost in that conversation. And it's a section called Roxbury. And I grew up in a housing project called Orchard Park. And it was my mom and my older brother and myself. And, you know, it was a housing project where it was great at first. And then once drugs were introduced into those communities, you know, it became like the Wild Wild West. And you know, you really had to kind of figure out life on the fly, you know, when you're looking at it from my perspective, because I was so young at the time. And my mother's sole reason for coming down here, and I don't think I've ever told this story. Her and my godmother was worked the third shift, and they were going to work. And one night my mother just didn't feel good, so she stayed home. And my godmother went to work anyway. And when she was let off at the bus station, she was duct tape and tied up by some gang members for the affiliation, and they set her on fire. And she ended up living, but my mother, obviously it did something to her psyche, because if she was with her that night, then, you know, chances are she would have been involved in the same activity. So she migrated down to Raleigh, where my grandmother was already living, and my mother already had North Carolina ties because she was from Dunn, North Carolina anyway. So she was in search of the American dream, and that's how we relocated back to Raleigh, North Carolina.
She moved from Dunn originally, as you say, raised in Dunn, right? Mm-hmm.
Raised in Dunn, and she left at 17 to go pursue the American dream. She went to California, L.A., just try to figure it out. Yeah. You know, because back then in those rural areas, people were growing up on tobacco fields and, you know, going to work, and she was like, this ain't for me. Let me see what the world has to offer. And she went to Los Angeles, and, you know, my brother was born, and then she moved from L.A. to Boston and had me, and we migrated back down to Raleigh, North Carolina.
So talk about Raleigh and the neighborhood you moved into there.
It was really a great place, you know, for kids. And because what I found is when we moved to Lane Street, the drug epidemic didn't hit down here as fast as it hit up north. Mm-hmm. So it was coming, but it was really a great place in terms of growing up. But once the drugs hit again, you know, it became a community where every time you walked out of your home, you were literally making a life or death decision. And that was critical for my brother and I because we were latchkey kids. So our mom worked 2 and 3 jobs. So we were often at home, you know, by ourselves. And, you know, from there you had, this was the time, 84, this was the time Ronald Reagan passed the 100-to-1 legislation where you were basically, the drug dealers were basically getting and receiving more time for crack cocaine than a convicted murderer. So what the drug dealer said, okay, well, we're going to find a gray area around this, so we'll put the drugs in the kids' hands. And so they started recruiting kids of our age, yeah, to sell the drugs for them. And ultimately what happened, the kids were getting robbed by the older guys, and they would go back and report to their drug dealers. And so the drug dealers now put guns into their hands to say, defend yourself and defend, you know, my product by any means necessary. And that's how guns got in the hands of kids. So before you know it, it's crazy because you have kids getting snatched off of playgrounds because of a drug that their cousin owed. Right. You know, so it was kind of the Wild Wild West, in a sense. And, you know, now you're knocking on your friends' doors and their mother's not looking the same because now they're strung out on the drugs. So I saw firsthand what crack cocaine did to our community and as well as other drugs and the violence and, you know, the betrayal and the trust and just the sense of it took away the innocence of our neighborhood. And fortunately for me, you know, I had some people that surrounded me. And
well, talk a little bit more about that, because you say now, you know, you can look back and you can see the a loss of innocence. But I'm guessing at the time, if you don't see any other way out, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but if you don't see any other way out, it might have looked pretty romantic to you, and this might have been your future, right?
Yeah, it was just the norm. Yeah. You know, you go into school and you're engaging with your teachers, and they're bringing in police to talk to you, and the policeman is such a great guy. He's telling you how he protects and serves the community, but when you go home, you don't see them protecting and serving. You know, my first encounter with a policeman was I was selling magazines for my AAU trip, just to fund my AAU trip. And it was like these subscription magazines. You just knock on people's doors and see if they're interested in buying a Sports Illustrated, the Time, or whatever. And I thought I did a pretty good job. And I was on my way back, and I was counting the money, and a cop pulled up beside me. And he took my money, and he slammed me up against the car because he swore it was from dealing drugs. And it was really a weird situation, man. Like, it was the ideal versus the realistic. Because the neighborhood drug dealers had some of the cops on their payroll as well. So it was, you know, it's a lot of stories that people are immune to because they would have no idea of what goes on in these communities. And that's where I grew up, you know. But needless to say, it taught me some valuable lessons.
AAU, of course, as an amateur athletic, so you're going to go off on a trip for sports. So but talk about how difficult it is to keep a young person out of that and the lengths your mother had to go, as you say, working a couple of jobs to keep you from becoming a part of that life.
You know, one thing I've always said about, you know, those communities and those situations and circumstances, it's always going to test three things. It's going to test your faith. It's going to test your character. And it's going to test your discipline. Every single day. You can say you are this person, but when that opportunity presents itself and you don't have any food in that refrigerator and your mother's 3 months behind on rent and you don't know what's going to be for dinner that night and someone asks you to walk a package of crack from this block to that block for $200, what are you going to do? And that's always going to be the line that you can stay over here or you can cross it. But you're faced with that reality every single day. And that's why I try to be adamant about helping people in those communities now. Because I made it out, you know, the challenge is still on. It's still the same fight, but it's just a different round for those people. And I just try to provide opportunities for them so they don't have to be a casualty of the system.
At the time, what was it that your mother and perhaps others within your community were doing? Or how were you? I mean, because at a certain point, did you find yourself wanting to participate in that? Did they have to keep you away? Or did you just say to yourself, well, I'm not going to be part of this?
No, I would, you know, if I'm being completely honest, I wish I could say, you know, I neglected it and said, you know, I'm not going to indulge or didn't have any kind of temptation to indulge, but it's only a matter of time before you wonder, okay, my father's not in this home. My older brother is struggling. I'm struggling. We have one pair of shoes. Those shoes have holes in it. My mother, we don't have any health benefits. We don't have any dental benefits. We don't have any medical benefits. She's behind on rent. What is it about this life that can get that maybe I can get involved and this can help my mother? Not to get involved in that life and just be some neighborhood drug dealer and not and have fame in that life. No. It was strictly, you strictly want to help your mother by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone in America, if presented with that opportunity, when their back is against the wall, they'll do anything out of desperation to help their family. So it was no different. for me, fortunately, my grandmother was really a spiritual woman. And when I was young, she always prayed or made me pray with her. And she would ask God to bless her kids' kids. And I really didn't know at the time what I was praying about. But now I'm a grown man. I understand that I'm a product of my grandmother's prayer. So I firmly believe that I was covered every day I walked outside of that door. And you saw your friends getting killed at 12. You saw your friends getting killed at 13. You saw your friends now going to jail in federal prison, receiving or being tried as an adult. And so there was consequences to those actions. And I was fortunate enough not to ever indulge and not to receive any of those consequences as a result.
Lavelle Moten is my guest. He's the head coach of the North Carolina Central men's basketball team. He carried the team to their first Mideastern Athletic Conference championship in 2014 and has kept the team looking strong ever since. We will continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, Lavelle Moten is my guest, the head basketball coach of the North Carolina Central men's basketball team. He led that team to the first MEAC Conference Championship a couple of years ago, and he's here to talk about his personal life. So growing up in Raleigh after that time in Boston, you did make it out. Your grandmother very close to you? Were you living close together? And she was an important part
of your life. Yeah, you know, the unique thing, I stayed on Jones Street and she stayed on Lane Street. So it was one block over, still in the same housing project, though. Still what was considered the housing project.
And now, and you're staying with her, and your mom. Tell us about your dad. Now, he left, and how big a part was he in your consciousness? Were you thinking about him? Did you stay connected with him or see him often?
Yeah, both directly and indirectly. You know, when we were in Boston, I was 4 years old. Anytime someone struggled to pay their rent for that month, you know, they had this creative way of helping them and assisting them within the projects. They would have this thing called a rent party. So everyone would, you know, somebody would open their home and it would basically serve as a nightclub, and people would pay entry to get into the the party, and they would take the money and then give it to the person in need. I hated these things because that mean people would bring their kids, and now I got 25 kids in my bedroom, and I hated them. And you know, this particular night, man, I remember it like it was yesterday, that you know, my father came in the room and he took our order. He said he was going to the store, and you know, he took everyone's order, and I just ended up falling asleep. And when I woke up, he wasn't there. And I asked my mom the following morning, like, you know, where is he at? And I was asking about him because I was really concerned with my chips and my drink that he hadn't delivered on. And she said, he's gone and he ain't coming back. And from that moment on, I never respected him anymore, and I resented that. And it was taboo for me to discuss my father in the home after that, because I'm dealing with the fact that he's not here. My father's not here. She's dealing with the fact that her man is no longer here. So it was kind of taboo, and it was her coping mechanism to deal with it. And I carried that hurt and that pain because I always felt as if the man that created me didn't love me enough to stay, then why would anyone else? So any relationship that I encountered along the way, I never expected anyone to stay. And I always had trust issues with people. And I had this deep, dark insecurity about myself. And it took me years upon years upon years to get over it. And even as a 43-year-old man, I'm not so sure I'm over it now.
You did a lot of writing at the time, right?
I did a lot of writing at the time. It was my way of expressing myself. It was therapeutic. It was cathartic for me. I would write down my feelings. My teacher always made us write down. The first 10 minutes of class would be these things we called journals. So I would write in that journal, and I always wrote about a message to myself, how I felt at that particular time, because my mother was so busy and my brother was 5 years older, so I really had no one to talk to. So that was my way of speaking to myself and encouraging myself and becoming my own cheerleader to get myself through those dark days.
What kind of messages? What were you writing?
You know, one day it may be, and I would talk to myself in third person. Everyone called me Puffy, so I would say, Puffy, you know, you got to keep your head up today. I know things are not going the way you would want them to go right now, but Just keep your head up, and one day you'll be a far better man than he ever will be. So it's crazy, but I made a conscious decision in fifth grade that I was going to have a beautiful family one day. I was going to have a little boy, and I was going to name him Lavelle Moulton Jr., and I was going to be a far better father than my father ever had.
Spoiler alert, that part of it has happened, right?
Yeah, that there part of it has right? happened. It didn't happen in fifth grade. But
okay, you waited.
Yeah, I waited.
Well, whose voice, did you have a sense at the time where that voice was coming from? Did you ask yourself, where is this coming from?
You know, I always felt like, again, my grandmother's prayers, man, like she, you kind of feel when you're connected spiritually, you don't have to be the most religious person, but when you're connected spiritually, you can feel things that others really can't feel. And it's almost like you're touched by an angel. And I always thank God for giving me a vision beyond my present set of circumstances, because even though I was labeled an outcast, or I was one of the half-nots, or, you know, I come from a place where we were the last of the respected, I still saw a vision. I could see tomorrow. Most people in my community couldn't see tomorrow. They couldn't see 10, 15 years down the road. I could see these moments. It wasn't as crystal clear as I would hope for it to be, but I knew in my heart of hearts that I was going to be something and I was going to make it out. And
you had other angels around you as well, a group of men, especially as you got involved in sports,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
You know, it was really a unique situation because I always judge people by their consistent pattern of behaviors towards me. Especially in my community, I didn't judge people based off what they did, because I knew they did whatever they did, whether it was legal or illegal, based off of desperation. And I was fortunate because the neighborhood drug dealers and some of what many would consider the bad guys, you know, I had inquired about getting in the drug game and what is that like. And those inquiries got back to them. And I don't know how they did it, because we didn't have text messaging then, but they called the neighborhood meeting. And I just remember walking up to the basketball court, which is the cornerstone of every neighborhood. And they grabbed me by my chest. And they was talking to everyone else, but they said, listen here, if I see you selling anything to him, giving anything to him that's illegal, there's going to be some consequences and repercussions.
Who are these men?
One of the guys, Robert Mitchell, and they called him Slick in my neighborhood. And he was so well respected. He was really feared. And I never knew why he was feared. He was like 5'10", he was like 5'9", 5'10", but everyone was scared of him. And he had a football team. And he asked me to be his quarterback on that team. So he became like the father I never had. As well as I joined the boys club, and there was a guy by the name of Ron Williams who also became a father I never had. And him and Slick were really close friends. And then there was another guy that was a local guy in our neighborhood named Julius Dillard. We called him Beefy. And those guys were so feared and so respected within the street that once they put word out that no one was to even have conversation with me or give me anything illegal or allow me to get into anything illegal as such, you know, it was crazy for me.
They were collectively known as the OGs, right?
Yeah, they were my OGs in my neighborhood, and they gave, like, I still talk to all of them to this day. They're beautiful individuals. They come to most of my basketball games, and I'm alive today simply because of them.
All of this stuff is going on all around them. Mm-hmm. They know everything, clearly. Right. They get word that you have made your inquiries, mm-hmm. and that's just enough to jack you up and sell you the word of God. Why you? Why not everybody else in the neighborhood?
You know, I think, you know, the thing about our neighborhood is when they see potential in an individual, it's almost like they kind of live vicariously through you. And they don't want you to make the same mistakes or go down the same road or go down the same path that they were on. Because in hindsight, and now, you know, Julius ended up serving, BV ended up serving maybe 20 years in the federal penitentiary. And when he got out, you know, him and I had a conversation. He said, as externally, what the lifestyle I was living looked so good. But he said, internally, I didn't want you to have that because I couldn't lay my head down at night in peace, not knowing who was going to, you know, come for me or I had to go back at. And, you know, it was really weird. And they solved any itching that I had about those situations. One day I was at one of their homes, me and my brother, and they had a gun, and we knew where the gun was. They kept the gun in the glove compartment, and it was a 357 Magnum, I'll never forget. And they were in the store, and they came out, and they saw us playing with the gun. We're literally playing with the gun. And they said, man, what are you doing with that? And they snatched it from me. And I was like, man, I just was grabbing it. I didn't know, you know, the magnitude of it at the moment. And he said, okay. And he gave me the gun back. And he said, put this gun up to my head. And I said, what? He said, put this gun up into my head. I said, man, I'm not putting this gun up to my head. He said, no, put this gun up to my head and pull the trigger. I said, no, I could never do that. He said, well, if you can't do that, you can't be involved in this game because there's going to come a time where you may have to do that. And I was out. That was it for me. I was like, you know what? Let me sign me up for the next science fair project. I'm out of this. You know, that was too much for me.
Science fair and sports. And at 11 years old, you spot a Pepsi truck that offers the possibility of the Pepsi Challenge. Yeah. Tell us about that.
I'm going into the boys club. There's a Pepsi truck outside, and I'm thinking they're just restocking the soda machines as usual. As I walk in, I see these Pepsi banners and mats all on the floor, and there's a competition going on inside, and my friends rush to me, and they're trying to explain the rules to me. They said, man, you got to try this. And I was like, man, I'm not doing that. This looks corny. Like, I want to play 5-on-5. I don't want to do no competition. And so Ron Williams, who's the director of the boys club and one of the guys I just told you about, he came over and he explained the rules to me. He said, listen, man, just make as many shots as you possibly can in a minute span. And I did it. And when I finished, people ran on the court and they lifted me up and all of this stuff. And they said, like, you set a new record for a 10, 11-year-old. And I was like, what is it? And I didn't care about the record. The winner just got a 2-liter Pepsi, and I just wanted that to take home to my mind. Forget this record y'all talking about. And they gave me the 2-liter Pepsi, and they said, man, you just set a record. You won the city finals for this. So now, I didn't know when you win the city, you go to the state the following weekend. So now I'm in Charlotte, and I'm shooting, and I win again. And then I go to Atlanta for the Southeast region, and I shoot, and I win again. And I didn't know once I won. This was at Georgia Tech, so now I'm shooting in front of 5,000 people. Well, I win the Georgia Tech competition, I mean the Southeast Atlanta region, and then I'm going to shoot halftime at the Washington Bullets game then in D.C., and they're flying me into D.C., and I'm shooting on national television. And that was one of those moments that really changed my life because it was the first time my talents had taken me outside of my neighborhood. So I had finally seen something outside of this 4-block radius that was on the strength of me that could ultimately get me out, get me an education. Now I see why they saying, keep your head on straight and you have something to live for. I was flying in and I remember it was a 39-minute flight. I flew in with Ron and now I'm seeing things that I had only seen in history books. The memorials, the White House, the monuments, all of those things. And, you know, we got a chance to go meet Ronald Reagan, who was the president at the time. Mm. And, you know, I'm touring the White House at 10. Then I'm shooting on TBS at halftime. And it was so much hysteria around it because I had an entire community representing me. So that's why they never let me indulge in anything. It's like, nah, you can make it out of here. And that was the turning point of my life, honestly.
And you were 11.
I was 11.
So what happened next? You pursued basketball.
Yeah, I pursued. Well, baseball was my favorite sport. And, you know, baseball was easy. I was better in baseball. I was the quarterback in football. I did everything just to keep myself involved in some extracurricular activities. In basketball, I had to work at that. That was a little more difficult. So I played it all throughout middle school. I played it out. Little League, Junior League, up until I ended high school.
How about college?
I didn't do it in college because, you know, they wanted me to let something go, you know, because it was so time consuming.
Where'd you go?
North Carolina Central. Yeah. So yeah. I ended up choosing basketball because I was a small guy in stature And I was seeing the licks that these guys in football was delivering. So I was like, you know what? Let me save that. And then baseball kind of was conflicted with AAU during the spring. So I just had to choose. And, you know, fortunately, I earned a scholarship to North Carolina Central.
Played basketball there. Talk about you ended up being named the Intercollegiate Association Men's Basketball Player of the Year in 96, right?
Right.
You're pretty good.
Yeah, that was okay.
So what were you thinking? What were you thinking now? You're going to Central. You're getting your degree. What were your plans at that point?
You know, my plan and my primary objective has always been to get my mother out of those circumstances. And so I went to college as a kid. You know, I wanted to have fun in college, but I knew there was a bigger picture and a primary objective, because the worst thing that you could do where I'm from is go to college and return home with nothing to show for it. And I knew I had an opportunity that others didn't get, because in 40 years of our housing project, only 6 kids went to college and 2 was from under my mother's roof. So I knew the magnitude of the situation that I was in, and I knew in order to garner what I ultimately wanted, I had to sacrifice something. And I sacrificed my social life in college. You know, I didn't do a lot of partying. I didn't do a lot of hanging out. I was always in the gym 24/7, you know, because I said, you got to give up something to get something. And even now, when I go back to homecoming, I struggle with people's names. I know faces, but I struggle with their names, because I really didn't get a good gauge to interact and have those and develop those interpersonal relationships. But I just wanted to go there and establish a name for myself and leave a legacy, you know.
Well, you got a name. You went from Puffy on the streets to Poetry and Moten.
Poetry and Moten.
Not bad.
That was a cool nickname that was given to me by my SID department.
So talk about your degree and what happens when you get out. You want to do something, and you get an offer from you played professional basketball, not NBA, but you played professional basketball.
1 year with the Supersonics at the time, and then 7 years overseas. And, you know, I'm at this time, I'm tired because you're overseas 10 months out of the year. And this is pre-internet, pre-computers. Like, so you're really over there feeling like a foreigner. So by the time you come to the States, it's only for like a month and a half, and it's time to head right back over for training camp. And the weirdest thing happened to me. A teacher who was my favorite teacher in seventh grade, by the name of Celia Selden, she was now the assistant principal at West Millbrook Middle School. And I saw her, and she said, I know you're still playing ball, but she said, if you want to come coach at West Millbrook, we would love to have you. And at the same time, my college coach who at North Carolina Central, Greg Jackson, he's now at Delaware State, and he's offering me a job to be his assistant coach for $85,000 a year. So now I got a decision to make, which is, do I take the $85K or do I take the $200 a month for 3 months? And I ended up choosing the $200 a month job for 3 months. Again,
why?
I was touched by angel. I always went through with my gut. I always went through every decision I've ever made. I never made it for money, because I've been broke far longer than I ever had a dime in the bank. So I understand the level of happiness and what true happiness is. And I always wanted to listen to my intuition. I felt like your intuition is listening to God's whispers. And oftentimes they say women have them, but I'm a firm believer that men have them too. And I was just, my intuition was just telling me, take this middle school job for $200 a month for 3 months. And I did. And, you know, I never looked back.
And it became more than that. You ended up teaching at the school as well.
Yeah. I see Miss Selden hustled me, because after a month, she came back and she said, you know what? These kids love you so much. Would you mind teaching? And I was like, oh, no, I'm not going to teach. I said, this is my karma for all the hell that I put my teachers through. So nah, I'm not doing that. And she's like, no, it'll be great. We'll give you a curriculum. You'll go back to school and you'll get your certification. And she just had a way of convincing me to do something I probably didn't want to do. And ever since I was 12, so I ended up doing it. And I loved it. I loved it.
What were you teaching?
Language arts. Mm-hmm. So for the poetry unit, they gave me the freedom and liberty to do what I wanted to do for the poetry session. And I remember, like, for elements of plot, you know, which is the exposition, rise in action, climax, fall in action, resolution, instead of doing Shakespeare, we did Good Times, which was one of my favorite shows growing up. And so for me to introduce a demographic of kids in North Raleigh to Good Times, like they lost their mind. And it was the episode where Janet Jackson was the little girl. They couldn't believe it was Janet Jackson. So I had their full divided attention and undivided attention. So it was really a cool thing. And I loved it because that was the innocence of kids. And you saw a lot of kids that reminded you of you at that age.
And that poetry is found in places where you might not have thought you could find poetry.
Absolutely, man. And it was a beautiful thing. So for the poetry session, you know, with the haikus and the limericks and those things, we did spoken words. So we cut the lights off and we lit candles and we allowed the kids to come tell their poems. I mean, say their poems. And it was really heartfelt. Like, kids, we would snap when we thought something was deep. Like, we had an amazing time, man. I enjoyed those kids and I love them to this day.
Talking to the head coach of the North Carolina Central Division I men's basketball team, the Eagles head coach, Lavelle Moten, is on the show today. And that conversation will continue on the state of things in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. I'm talking with the head basketball coach of the North Carolina Central Eagles. He is with us today on the State of Things. And you wrote a book about your life, many of these stories. Tell us how you came to North Carolina Central. You turned down the big job initially, but eventually you found yourself back there.
You know, I thought we had success in middle school, but I wasn't getting the fulfillment, the competitive fulfillment from it because, you know, I wanted more. And as fate would have it, my 10th grade French teacher was now the principal, Kathy Moore. She was now the principal at Sanderson High School. And she asked me to come be the head coach at Sanderson High School. So I agreed. And, you know, before I got there, Sanderson was one of the worst basketball programs ever because I competed against them when I was at Enloe. And I hated playing them because we wouldn't even play. You only play like a quarter before, you know, it just wasn't a great game. Yeah. So long story short, she gave me the job, and I was extremely fortunate for it. And she believed in me because other high schools had turned down my resume. And I always remembered that in the back of my mind. And, you know, I kept that and used it as motivation. And I had some outstanding kids, and we were able to win two conference championships and go to the regionals and state. And by this time, North Carolina Central is saying, okay, we're going to D1. We're making this transition from D2. Would you mind coming to be our assistant coach? And I gladly declined. I said thank you, but no thank you. You know, I was happy. I was a single man. I thought teaching was the best job on earth because you get to teach and coach, and I had my basketball camps. I was training NBA players, and I was off for 3 months in the summer. I thought that was the best job on earth at the time. I just wasn't exposed to the job world just yet. And I ended up praying about it, and, you know, I made the move to come back to North Carolina Central. And after 2 years, they decided to name me head coach. And, you know, it's been a blessing ever since.
You said D2 and D1, of course, Division I. So that's the bigs. Yeah. That's what gets you into the tournament and all of that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Well, so what was it like to suddenly become a head coach of a Division I basketball team?
You know, it was really, I had to find comfort in discomfort, if you understand. Like, it was something I felt like I was qualified for, but I knew external individuals were saying he's too young, he didn't have any experience, because I think I was the second youngest coach in the nation at that time. And I just remember interviewing in front of the committee, and they said, well, you don't have any experience. Like, how are you going to run a program? You didn't have a coach that taught you the ropes. And I said, look, I'm going to run my program the same way my mother and my grandmother ran their homes, with the same core values. And if I can make it out of those circumstances to this point, I'm sure those same core values can help us win championships and graduate kids and allow them to go out here in this world and be productive citizens. And I think that won them over because it was truth, it was candid, and I was honest. I wasn't trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes and say I read a book about John Wooden and Dean Smith. No, I was going to do it the best way I knew how. And I was convicted in my beliefs, and I think, you know, once I showed them how convicted I was within my beliefs, they became convicted in their beliefs in me.
Well, what's the combination of the chemistry and all of this? Because you have received accolades from some of the recognized bests in the business, the Roy Williams and the Coach K's, for your basketball acumen, how the way in which you design your teams and play basketball and coach your teams to play. So there's a certain amount of athleticism and strategy. But as you say, getting to know your players and working with them as young men, What's the math here? What's the blend of these things?
You know, I just think, you know, as a coach, you know, it's only 350 of us in the nation, so it's you're a rarity. You're somewhat of a novelty. But I just think you have to be convicted in your beliefs in terms of, number one, your primary objective while dealing with these kids. I see coaches succeed and I see some coaches fail, and I see so many coaches fail because they value winning over everything. And I worry about that, because if that's what you value over everything, then you're going to be emotional wreck. I'm fortunate that I came into this business as a devoted coach who just wanted to teach kids and took a check for $200 a month for 3 months. Obviously, I didn't do that for the money. I did it because I wanted to help kids that looked like me out of some circumstances. And just because I've ascended to this level of a collegiate head coach, that primary intent for me has never changed. And I think that allowed me to put basketball in its proper perspective, and winning basketball games in its proper perspective, but caring and loving about loving these kids in their proper perspective. Am I demanding? Yes. But I try not to be demeaning. I'm extremely real with these kids about what awaits them in this world. I tell them exactly what they need to hear and not what they want to hear. And for that, I'm not always popular with them, and I understand that, but I've made a conscious decision. I'm 40. I don't need any 19-year-old buddies, right? Right? Like, my job is not to be your buddy. Yeah. My job is, when you leave here, you're readily prepared for this world. And I'm not going to sit here and talk to you about going to the NBA, because that's less than the 1%. You know, I'm talking to the 99.5%. What happens when that basketball stops bouncing? How do you operate in this world? Because no one cares. This world does not care that you were all conference in high school. And in a couple of months after your senior year, when you swipe your ID, you can't go in the cafe and eat for free no more. So those same meals that you complain about in the cafeteria, those 21 meals per week, you'll be begging to receive those 21 meals per week. And we have those candid conversations, and it's never changed. And as a result, I had some outstanding basketball players that went out on that floor and tried to play extremely hard for me and execute what we've asked them to do. And I received some credit that I probably didn't deserve for that.
What is it? I mean, what's the in college basketball? It seems to me that's a tougher sport to coach than even professional basketball, or very different in some ways, because these kids are so young, because the very cream of the crop, the top talent, is gone in a year or two. Right. So you can't really have the very, 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 very best. Right. So you're dealing with very good players, excellent players, but they're here for just a very short time, and they're very young. And dealing with them emotionally, it seems to me, is a whole different skill set than what you might need as a pro.
Honestly, you know, we talk, as a coach, you're not just a basketball coach. I think we talk about basketball maybe 5% of the year. The other 90-95% is spent on being guidance counselors. You know, I mandate that my staff take each one of my staff members have a caseload. Maybe they're assigned 5 kids apiece, and their job is to take these kids to lunch once a week and just talk to them, not about basketball, but just talk outside of campus. I don't care where you take them, Subway, Burger King, Ruth Chris, I don't care. But just go talk to these kids, because they have so much that's going on in their mind. And they still have the external pressures of achieving and doing what we asked them to do, but also the social media aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And then the demands from their parents, you know. So it's just a different generation of kids that you're dealing with. And instead of saying, wow, these kids are crazy, these kids are such and such, you just have to adjust in a leadership position with the times as these kids. And I feel like the majority of people in leadership positions haven't adjusted with this generation of kids. Mm-hmm. And because the truth of the matter, I think I read a quote one day, and it said, you know, this generation of kids, they're disrespectful, they're entitled, they think they're privileged, they think the world revolves around them, they don't have no respect for elders, blah, 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 blah. And at the end of the quote, it was from Socrates. You know, so that was like 383. You know, so my point is.
So we've all been just misquoting somebody else. We're not even original in our ideas.
Yeah, that was like Socrates back in 383 AD or something. You know, so my point is, kids always been rebellious. They've always pouted to get their way. But the people in leadership positions, we have to do a better job of continuing to demand the best from them and stop giving in and lowering our standards for those kids, because we're doing them an injustice when they go out in this real world.
You have a foundation that focuses on single moms. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was important to you growing up and your mother's care and attention to you. Tell us about the foundation and what you do.
My nonprofit is called Vail Cares Foundation. And, you know, one of the toughest things about the foundation was me writing a mission statement, because my mission was to kind of help everyone. You know, I just didn't want to center it around one focus group. But, you know, one thing that I've tried to do is whoever and however that directly affects me, I'm not the guy to just put my name on it and somebody runs it. Like, I'm actively involved. I meet with my team. I tell them my expectations, and then they do a wonderful job of executing it. But, you know, one thing I wanted to do was honor single moms, because I knew the struggle of my mom. And I know that still exists. And there's so many times that those single moms don't receive their roses while they're here, when they're doing all that they have to do. So my Single Moms Foundation, we do it every year. We call it the Single Mother Salute. We honor 150 single moms, and we bring them in. And, you know, it's like a red carpet event. We give them a wonderful, beautiful dinner. They have pictures. So it's kind of like a prom atmosphere set up, where the focus is primarily on them. We give them these wonderful gift bags. And we give them like $30,000 worth of prizes. And, you know, they write in telling why they should be named Single Mom of the Year. And the awards are named after my mom. So we got the Single Mom of Courage, Love, Sacrifice, Strength, and et cetera, et cetera. And then we have the Single Mom of the Year. We give these beautiful awards based off the essays that they present. And we'll give some extracurricular prizes as well. You know, we give away vacations, we give away spa and manicure, pedicures, things that women would love that they don't find enough time to pamper themselves, because they're always concerning themselves with others.
You are a father yourself, as yes. We foreshadowed in the earlier part of our program. Yeah. Tell us about being a dad and your kids.
It's the most remarkable thing ever. You know, it's I have a revelation. I have a clarity now. And I don't know if it was when I turned 40 or when I became a father, or just probably a combination of both. My kids are wonderful. My daughter is 9 years old. Her name is Brooke. And my son is 5 years old, and he's Lavelle Jr. And they're my world. They're my heart and soul. And they put everything into perspective. One thing I figured out is life is about perspective. You know, it's not what you see, it's how you see it. And what you see is what you get. So if you have an ill perspective, your life is going to be out of whack, out of control. But I don't take myself seriously, because I'm not Coach Moten. I'm not any award winner when I walk in that house. I'm daddy. They don't care how tired I am from a recruiting visit. They don't care how tired I am from practice. Hey, let's play right now. Teach me how to ride my bike. Pass me this basketball. Let's play Barbie dolls. So I do all of that. And fatherhood is like a beautiful thing to me. It's the best job on earth.
Earlier in the program, you talked about your resentment and anger at your father for having left, and you said to some degree you're still not sure you've processed that. I mean, where are you with that now, and how does that play into your sense of being a father now?
Yeah, it's funny you ask, because I truly realize I resent him more. I resented him more when I became a father, because I was like, yo, how can you miss it? Like, this is the greatest thing. And he never was there with me to ride a bike. He never played catch with me. He never sat me on my lap and read a book. He never took me to Frankie's. He never did any of that. He didn't see any event that I had at school. He never came to a game, and never played hide and seek with me, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that I do with my kids. And so every time I do something with my kids, there's a thought process in the back of my mind to say, like, wow, you didn't even think enough of me to do any of this with me. And there's a part of me that will never understand how a man just walks out on his family and leave. Like, I didn't know what was worse, not having a father at all, or just having him for 4 years and him leaving. You know, I'd just rather to not have him at all, because you don't have to live with the residual effects of him walking away. Mm-hmm. And that's something I have to do. I've received counseling. I started going to counseling, you know, a couple of years ago, just to shake that weight off my shoulder.
Yeah, it's understandable. But it's interesting, too, to see how open you are and open-minded you were with the people you grew up with, because you understood that they did what they had to do. And now when it comes, it's this personal. It's a Yeah. It's a harder thing to.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, what's interesting is that you come from that neighborhood in and that housing project in Boston. And mm-hmm. there's another Durhamite who we've talked to on this very program, Joe Bush fan, who came out of that. And there were a couple of other people, right? Donna Summer came
Donna
out
Summer,
of there. And
New Edition.
And New Edition. Yeah. And that was, in a way, Joe Bush. He had Joe's Hot Dogs for a long time at Angier and Driver Street. And so have you caught up with him, your old Boston running mate? Well, you were probably a little younger than him.
Well, you know, the crazy thing is, you know, in our neighborhood, everyone has nicknames for some reason. So, you know, the hardest thing to remember is their government name. So I didn't know him as Bush fan. I was so young, and he was such he was one of the older guys, but he was one of the older guys in our neighborhood that you didn't play with. And, you know, like I said, this is 82, 83 around that time. So New Edition now has this record on the charts called Candy Girl. And it went too fast. It's taken the world by storm. And so now they're leaving the projects and they're going on this world tour. Now you got to get bodyguards and all of these things. So they just took the guy that was most feared in our neighborhood. And that was Joe. And we called him Mackie at the time. And, you know, he became the bodyguard for New Edition. And then when Bobby Brown went solo, he became the bodyguard for Bob. And, you know, then Earth, Wind & Fire and Alicia Keys, and that kind of propelled him into the business. And, you know, it was weird. I'm in my office one day down here, and my athletic director said, I just had some wonderful food at this place called Joe's Diner. And the guy said he knew you. And I was like, no, I don't know no Joe's Diner. You know, I said, I never heard of it, never ate there. She said, you might need to check, because he was real adamant about knowing you. And he even called you Puffy. I was like, oh, Puffy. So I go to Joe's Diner. I look it up, and I go there, and I order. And I see him, and we just, like, it's such an emotional hug, man, because, you know, how can someone just relocate from the same housing project, and now they're two blocks away from you, and he has this outstanding business that has people outside of the doors waiting to get in to get his food and so on and so forth, man. So we reminisced, man, and we caught up. Last summer as well, Bobby Brown came here to do a show in Raleigh, and Bobby asked me to meet him at the hotel, him and his brother Tommy, and I met him over there, and we were just talking, and he said, man, I can't believe we were reconnected like this. And I said, man, let me call Mackie. He's like, Mackie's here? I said, Mackie's 10 minutes away from here. He said, no way. And I called him, so we're all going to Bob's concert, and Bob pulled the van over, and he says, like, man, can you believe we all connected? Like, how is this happening? We in Raleigh, North Carolina, we've all connected because we made it out of Orchard Park, man. So it was really a touching moment and a moment I'll never forget. So shout out to Mackie. I love you, boy, if you're listening.
And to you, Lavelle Moten, head coach of the North Carolina Central Division I men's basketball team, carried the team to the first Mideastern Athletic Conference championship in 2014, and his book, Collected Stories About His Life Growing Up, The Worst Times Are the Best Times. Lavelle Moten, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed myself.
You can find more at our website, stateofthings.org, from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.